Imagine a working life that saw you locked in a cold refrigerator drawer at a morgue one day and dining in the finest Michelin star restaurant in Paris the next. That was the life of my guest this morning for 30 years. Good morning. This is Life Matters. I'm Ellen Fanning, and in the studio with me, Nick Lee, a camera operator on 60 Minutes. He started work the moment the clock started ticking on the Nine Network in 1979. There was a wonderful afternoon spent alone with the genius of Michelangelo in that working life, filming the Sistine Chapel. A day spent at home with Katharine Hepburn, and the horror of finding buckets of blood in the torture chambers of Idi Amin's Uganda. This morning we're going to hear the story of his working life from his new book, All This in 60 Minutes. It was, Nick, I think, news gathering before the internet. I've described you here as having the ultimate fly-in, fly-out marriage. Guilty?
Guilty. Guilty, all right. It certainly was.
And listener, if you think getting on with your working colleagues is tricky, Nick here managed to live, eat and work with everyone from the very affable Ray Martin to Richard Carlton, who you once described as without doubt the rudest man you'd ever met.
I did. In fact, it was more than a description. I actually told him to his face. I said, Richard, without doubt, you are the rudest man I've ever met. And I thought, well, I'm fired now. There goes my job. And he said, you really think so, do you? I said, yes, I do.
This is like sitting in the back of a crew car with you driving around listening to your stories, and it's completely hilarious that there's an audience listening and we're on air. But we'll try and be professional.
Well, we did sit in the crew car very often, you and I, didn't we?
We did. Tell me about that first year, 1979. What did you think of the idea of being a cameraman for 60 Minutes? What did it promise for you?
Well, I had no idea what it was about. And Gerald Stone, the original executive producer, he just said, you're going to be travelling the world. That's it. And I thought, this is unbelievable. I can't believe my luck. Because I was unaware that there was already a CBS 60 Minutes in America that had been running. And so I thought, wow, I'm going to travel the world. And then I thought, oh, I'll see London, I'll see Paris. But I saw a bit more than that.
In that first year, and this story is actually on YouTube if the listener wants to have a look, 79, you're sent to report on what was left of Uganda in the wake of Idi Amin's brutal reign of terror, and 300,000 Ugandans, one in six in the population died. And it seems to me reading it that you wouldn't have been allowed to go these days. You flew in unprepared, relying on old-fashioned shoe leather to get the story. What did you find when you got there?
Well, we were in shock. We arrived, there were dead bodies all through on the street. We didn't know what to do. We just thought we'll go and see how Uganda is, because Idi Amin had taken off and Saudi Arabia had given him amnesty and allowed him to come in and be looked after. So we went in just to see what the country was like. The Tanzanians had invaded Uganda because Idi Amin had tried the other way around and he got done over. So there was full of Tanzanian soldiers and they'd just taken over. So they're walking around with machine guns and rifles and weapons, and we saw dead bodies, and it was just a nightmare. But we thought, oh, well, at least the Intercontinental has taken our booking, so we'll go to the pub, the hotel. So we turned up. Well, they looked at, they just stared and thought, are you kidding? Well, they'd actually taken a booking from Sydney, but they probably thought no one was stupid enough to actually come to Kampala. So we arrived and we walked in, and they said, no, there's no rooms here. And there's no other hotels. There was nowhere else to go. And I had 30 cases. And we'd also taken some food and a few bottles of wine in, just because we heard there'd be no food. And they said, you can't stay here. And we said, well, we're not leaving, because we bumped into Tony Joyce. Tony Joyce, the famous ABC reporter. Yeah. And he said, what are you doing here? And we told him. He said, you better be careful, because there's a curfew at 6 o'clock. And we were just about to go out and start filming.
Yeah.
It was about 5:30.
I mean, when you know, these days you don't get to walk out the door from any television station unless you know what you're going to shoot, who you're going to shoot, and if you've been through the course that the ex-commandos will give you on how to survive, and you know what the curfew is and all the rest of it. But it's interesting. It's sort of a tale about what happens if you go and report. In fact, it was your driver who ended up being the key to the story, a man called Isaac. What did he know about what had gone on?
Isaac Sawonga, what a beauty he was. We just found this. We hailed a taxi and he pulled up and we got in. And he turned out to be a beauty. So we asked him what had been going on and he told us, and he said the worst thing was the State Research Bureau, where Idi Amin tortured people. So we drove there, and Ian Leslie and Alan Hogan, the producer, got out to go and have a look inside. And I'm sitting in the cab with Isaac, loading up some film, and he's looking straight ahead, and he said, "I was in there. I was dragged in there, and I was in there for 3 weeks, and I was tortured." And I couldn't believe it. So I rushed in, grabbed Alan and Ian, and said, "You've got to get this bloke."
Well, let's listen to what Isaac told Ian Leslie about what went on in the State Research Bureau. Here they are in a small room inside the building.
What happened in this room? In this room, they used it to bring about 4 or 5 prisoners, putting them in one line here, and ordered them to run and knock their heads against the wall.
How would that happen? Tell them to run against that wall?
They count 1, 2, 3, you run and knock the head, then go back 1, 2, 3, and then you go.
Did men actually kill themselves by doing that? They actually died here?
You can kill yourself by doing it, by knocking the head against the wall.
But why would they do it? Wouldn't they refuse?
Some of them refused, and they were shot to death. If you refuse, you are shot to death.
But surely it would be better to be shot to death quickly than kill yourself like that.
Sometimes we may have a thought of having someone to save you from this place, knowing that by doing so, I can fall down and see someone whom I know who could help.
You mean that even at this time, there was still one tiny hope that you might survive?
Yes.
How did you cope with that? Because there's much more detail in the book about the horrors, and they're almost unimaginable.
It was unimaginable. It was horrible. But I started to wonder about the people in the world like Isaac that had actually been through it. I'm just hearing stories. That's all I'm doing. I'm in the cell where it all happened, but I'm not witnessing any of it. Not only did Isaac witness it, he was part of it. He was tortured. And I thought, what is it about these people that can survive and tell the story and not be angry, not be furious, not want revenge? He was a calm, friendly, happy taxi driver. And so, but then he took us into one area and there was a bucket of blood. And Ian leaned over, there was a rag hanging out of it, and Ian pulled the rag out. And I went down low to get a low shot of the rag coming out of it. And the stench was unbelievable. I've never smelt anything so bad in my life. Ian Leslie ran outside and threw up immediately, and I just felt like I was covered in filth. It was the worst. And it was blood. It was human blood that had been there for months. And then Isaac tells us that's all they had to drink. Mm. They were never given water.
And here's the thing that's so extraordinary and maybe common to people who go into war zones and conflict zones. The camaraderie kind of saves you. You know, you get out of there, you write that you're protected to some extent by the viewfinder. You see everything through a viewfinder, so at a remove. But you get to the fag end of the trip, you're back at the restaurant at the Intercontinental. The toilets are overflowing with sewerage. The water's only on for an hour a day. You're liable to have a gun stuck in your face by a soldier. But there's always the meal.
The meals were very important in 60 Minutes. I think I saw you eat quite a few myself.
This is your description of that meal in Kampala from the book.
Next day was Ian's birthday. We headed down to the chicken-only restaurant and asked if they had champagne. We figured we had a better chance of being served pheasant under glass, but there's no harm in asking. The friendly waiter said he'd check. Half an hour later, he returned with a bottle of Asti Spumante and said, "This is all we have. We'll take it." None of us had had a $6 bottle of Asti Spumante since we were 17, but our stash of vino was all gone, and after all, this was a celebration. "That will be $250 American dollars," said our smiling waiter. "We'll take it." Asti Spumante never tasted so good. I think it was the price tag. I love expensive wine.
Boom, boom. Gee, you can write. Who knew all that time?
Thank you, Ellen.
You do.
It was a lot of fun to do.
The book is laugh out loud funny, mostly at your own misfortune. But aren't you supposed to write a book that tells us how hard it was and how difficult it was and all the rest of it?
Well, yes, but I figure every journalist who's ever travelled the world has tried that. They try to say how, you know, how difficult it is, how hard it is, how they, you know, they put their hand to their forehead and say, "Oh, it's tough." So I just wanted something that was fun, something that was funny, and to tell people that life on the road is fun. Mm. Although I suspect it's a lot tougher for photojournalists when you're alone. I was with three other people So we just had a lot of fun together, the four of us.
There are moments that are just laugh-out-loud funny. In Egypt, you're waiting to interview President Anwar Sadat, who you describe as the most charismatic man you'd ever met, 18 months before he's assassinated. What possessed you to try the local delicacy, chicken livers?
Well, I figure when in Rome, but it was very silly of me. So in Cairo, I ate chicken livers. That was the end of me. I didn't leave the bathroom for 3 days.
What a time to be sharing a room, you wrote. Both ends of me opened up like Mount Vesuvius. It was relentless. I wanted to die, and I knew Peter, the sound man, lying on the other side of the paper-thin bathroom wall, was hoping my wish would come true. But then you must have made up for it by assignments like the Orient Express. That must have made a terrific story when it went to air.
Oh, top the ratings. It didn't make it to air. I'm very embarrassed to say it. I hope Gerald Stone's not listening. I think he hates the idea that we spent 3 days, four of us, on the Orient Express, where you had to wear a dinner suit after 6 o'clock, and it was nothing but champagne and quality food. So we forgot to work by the end of three
days. Sorry, you what?
We forgot to work. By the end of the third day, we didn't have a story. And we had to get off in Lucerne in Switzerland because geniuses like us only need 3 days to shoot a story, and we didn't have one.
So I mean, you had tried. There was a moment when you were trying to do a piece to camera with Ray, and the Alps were in the background as he was there in his sleeping carriage in all its finery. What went wrong?
Well, that piece to camera was going to be the piece de resistance to the whole story, even though we didn't have anything else. And so we pulled down the blinds, and Ray rehearsed, and I had to light. It was difficult to light because I'm trying to get the light to match the Swiss Alps on the other side.
So bright light through the window,
right,
and dark in the cabin.
Yeah. So I had to light Ray to buggery, you know, to try and match the outside. And so we pulled the blind down. Ray says, "You wipe the sleep and the slivovich from your eyes. You open the blind." And he was meant to say it's the Swiss Alps because that's what we rehearsed. So he said that. You open the blind and it's an effing tunnel. And so all we could see was our reflections in the window. There was no Swiss Alps. It was just we're in the middle of the longest tunnel in Europe. It was so we waited another hour, pitch black. When we came out, we'd hit the outskirts of Lucerne, which was just a dreadful industrial wasteland, and then we got off. We didn't have a story. And we thought, ooh, ah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, all this, of course, was made possible by Kerry Packer. You're very generous about most people in the book, but you're pretty – you saw the worst, I think, of Kerry Packer. You describe working on a documentary on World Series cricket, which you describe as a bludge going around the place filming all the various cricketers who defected to World Series cricket. And there was a day when Kerry brought the West Indies team along to his son James's school. What did you see that day?
Yeah, it was terrible. Kerry had financed the new cricket pitch, and the West Indies team had arrived to play against the Cranbrook 11, top 11, and so the first 11. So they're all practicing. The West Indies are bowling to them. Kerry says to me, "Put the camera down." So I put the camera down, and Jamie, his son, was there, who's now James. Jamie was there, and Kerry dragged the 10-year-old little Jamie to the pitch, to the wicket, gave him a bat, and said to the West Indies bowlers, "Now bowl to him." So the West Indies, they threw a tiny little soft thing, and Kerry said, "You will bowl full bore at him." So Jamie starts crying. And I can't shoot any of this because I've been told to put the camera down. So I watched the little boy sobbing as the West Indies fast bowlers, the fastest in the world, came running in, pretending to bowl fast to appease Kerry, but they were letting it go as loosely as possible. And poor old Jamie, it's a wonder he couldn't see the ball at all through the tears. And then after half a dozen balls, Kerry said, "Okay, that's enough," and walked away. Extraordinary.
Tough character.
But when you hear the stories of Kerry Packer, I suspect the same thing happened to him from his father.
There were tough characters on the road for you. There were tough producers, and then there was Richard Carlton, the man the audience loved to hate. I've often wondered what it would be like. You know, he famously sat down with the Bosnian Serb war criminal Radovan Karadzic and said, first question, how does it feel to be a mass murderer? You know, someone's...
He was scared of no one.
Well, except that, you know, there's other people in the room with the goons, with Radovan Karadzic, one assumes. I'm intrigued. Take us there. What's it like to be the person in the room when this is happening? Because there was a moment where you were interviewing an Indian mystic And this bloke had been inspired by the Beatles. But you'd worked out he was a fraud. And Richard was told, don't ask him any questions about the Beatles or the fraud. And you write that his first question was, what's your favourite Beatles song and can you hum us a few bars?
How good is that? It was the Maharishi Yogi who'd been ripping people off all around the world. I mean, I'm all for meditation and yoga. I think it's wonderful. But he went beyond that. He just exploited people and he ripped them off. But Richard had been explicitly told, do not mention the Beatles or we're in trouble. And Richard had had enough. This bloke was a con man, so Richard's first question was, as you said, what's your favourite Beatles song and can you hum us a few bars? Well, the producer, I looked across and saw the producer put his hands in his head and he's just shaking his head. But then Richard, sharp as a tack, said, well, but hang on. Oh, the Maharishi went off his brain and Richard said, hang on, but the Beatles made you. And he said, the Beatles didn't make me. And he went off. And then Richard just kept talking and the Maharishi fell for it and answered a few more questions. But I thought it was all over by then. But then Richard just kept hammering until it just came to an end. Yeah. We didn't get an interview.
You didn't?
No.
What happened with Michelle Pfeiffer? Surely Richard was bewitched by Michelle Pfeiffer.
Well, bewitched, but as he always said, he knows nothing about showbiz. Richard never read fiction, only non-fiction, was only interested in the news of the world, geography, history, that sort of stuff. Showbiz, pop culture, no knowledge, no interest. So we get to meet Michelle Pfeiffer, who was the hottest thing in the world at the time. He'd never heard of her. He had never heard of her. He had no idea who she was. So he sits down and as you've done it a million times, waiting for me to set up lights for the camera to go, you prattle. Richard didn't say a word.
No chat. Nothing. No pre-interview chat.
None. Sitting a metre from Michelle Pfeiffer. So she's sitting there wondering what the hell is going on, because most people crawl like crazy to a star like that and they're sycophantic and tell them how wonderful they are. Richard didn't say a word. Not a word. Just sat there until I said, okay, rolling. And then he hits her with some silly question that had nothing to do with films or being famous or anything, because he is not interested. But sometimes it worked. I was about to say it was silly to put Richard on those sort of stories, except sometimes his lack of knowledge of their whatever they were made a much better interview because he asked questions that they had never been asked in their lives.
And when did you figure him out? I mean, you had to convince him to try a pair of blue jeans on. You had to bring him up to date with popular music from 1942, you know, yep. After Tommy Dorsey, he went blank right up to the return of the century. When did you figure him out? Because at one stage, as we began by saying, you said, you are the rudest man I have ever met. And I can't imagine you being mad, angry enough at somebody. You're a friend to all.
Yeah, well, he didn't know my name for 6 months. He didn't call me by name. He didn't know my name. And I thought, I get on well with all the reporters, and I always have, and I don't know why I have trouble with this bloke. But after I'd said he was rude, he said, you really think so? And I said, yeah. And then that night we talked in the pub about it, and we were laughing. And something cracked and we just became good friends. And from then on, I love travelling with Richard. He's a really smart bloke. He's a really good bloke. He is a funny bloke. But the audience never got to see it. They just never got to see it. He was a great man.
You miss him?
I really miss him. I really do. He was terrific. And any time they said, you're going on a trip with Richard Carlton, I'd think, you beauty, this is going to be great.
My guest is Nick Lee. He spent 30 years at 60 Minutes as a cameraman, travelling the world, filming stories, the stars, the conflict zones, and it's all in his memoir, All This and 60 Minutes. Here's a story you shot with Richard Carlton. It was about a white supremacist, Eugene Terreblanche, in South Africa.
This land is the God's land. I cannot give God's land to Mandela and the communists.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In the Boer state, would you allow a Boer to marry a black?
No.
They believe they've got God on their side, and they sure as one thing have got guns in their belts. These are the white racists at their worst.
And Richard's talking there, Nick, surrounded by what you describe as a rabid mob of racists. Why was he whispering?
Because he didn't want them to hear. Had anyone heard, we'd be dead. They were rabid. They were nasty. Eugene Terreblanche was probably the nastiest bloke I've ever met. And he was still talking in the background. And Richard wanted to do it while all that was happening. And He had to do it quietly. It was really difficult for the sound man, Mickey Breen, really hard because of the ranting in the background.
You say best impromptu piece to camera you've ever seen.
The best. I couldn't believe it. And then we got out of there fast because they were a dangerous mob. It looked like a Nazi propaganda movie or the real thing. Or maybe Steven Spielberg had set up the whole thing. It was too good to be true. It was great for pictures. But we wanted to get out of there fast because they were a dangerous, scary mob.
You know, Nick, we've seen the 60 Minutes crew gets into lots of trouble in Beirut with the child abduction story. You were involved in filming a story on the IRA in Dublin with Mike Munro, and you were breaking all kinds of laws. How much strife were you putting yourself in? How much danger were you putting yourself in on that story?
Very dangerous because John Major was the Prime Minister. Margaret Thatcher was still in Parliament at the time. They'd both been targets of the IRA and they hated the IRA. And they were the nastiest, apart from maybe the PLO, they were the nastiest terrorists in the world at the time. And so we do a story inside the IRA when it started from Dublin. And it was a really full, you know, we had secret passwords. We weren't allowed to ring home. Andrea, the producer, had to go on buses and be told she'd be updated, and then there were people following her, and then the British forces were watching them watch us. It just went on and on and on. But we thought, well, at least we're in Ireland. We're in the Republic of Ireland, so we're safe. Then they took us to Northern Ireland illegally, and we thought we're in trouble here. If the POMs find us here, we'll be in jail for 20 years for sure. It was really frightening.
Here's part of that story.
We ended up at a deserted farmhouse where the IRA were waiting. They had already mounted a full-scale operation securing the area around the farmhouse. They maintained patrols the whole time we were there.
Why did you go? Why didn't you say, no, 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 I'm staying in Dublin. I'm not going. That's not part of the plan.
No,
it's illegal to be there. You know, these guys, you even write in the book, had a 12-millimetre machine gun which had brought down a Sphinx British helicopter the day before. Why were you there?
Well, we didn't know we didn't know they had shot down the helicopter, we just assumed. We didn't know they would have the weapon that did it. But we didn't know we were going to the north. We thought we were still in Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland. So we're driving along and Mike Munro says, where are we going? And the driver says, Armagh. Well, it didn't mean a thing to me. But Mike said, isn't that in the north? And they said, yep. And Mike said, we'll have to go through checkpoints. They said, no, we know how to get around them. So the fact that we're in Northern Ireland made it even worse had we been caught. We may have had a little protection from the government of the Republic of Ireland and maybe even Kerry Packer. But in Northern Ireland, which is POM land, you know, and Margaret Thatcher and John Major hate the IRA, had we been sprung, we would have got 20 years in the clink and Kerry Packer's money would have made no difference.
So there's a lot of trust, isn't there, in the producer, who is the person making a lot of these decisions. In this case, it was Andrea Keir, who you describe as a take-no-prisoners producer scared of no one. And there's an extraordinary moment when she was completely fearless in dealing with these masked, heavily armed IRA guerrillas, particularly when they failed to provide the electricity that they'd promised so you could shoot the story.
My colleagues finally turned up and I delivered the good news. Andrea hit the roof. She got stuck into the balaclava wearers, telling them how slack they were, how unreliable they were, how arrogant they were, how they'd lied to us, how far we'd come to do this documentary, how she had only yesterday got a message through to the executive producer that everything was going according to plan. And I'm not letting you idiots F up my story. Silence. These blokes kneecapped people for drinking in the wrong pub, but now they all look desperately at each other through eye holes in their balaclavas, terrified of this Australian banshee. Within minutes of Andrea's tirade, I had half a dozen helpers running metres of power cable borrowed from a nearby farmhouse, and I started setting up lights.
And it all went well from there.
And it all went well from there.
But
it was amazing.
I mean, I always think of you in the background thinking, this is my life. I have a wife. I have two children back in Sydney. This is all well and good, this exhilaration and bravado, but hey, careful, you got my life in your hands.
Oh, you're right. And maybe the older I got, the more I thought about it before I went away on a story. But a story like that, it didn't seem too dangerous when we left Sydney. And then, like I said before, we were in the Republic of Ireland. I thought we were safe. But even once we were there and I realised we weren't, we're in the north, we've got this weapon that shot down the Sphinx helicopter, what can I, I'm not going to say, no, I can't shoot this, I want to go home, and burst into tears. So you just stay there and you shoot it and you do the right thing and you have faith in the reporter and producer. And it worked out to be a great story, a great story.
Did you ever refuse to do a story?
Once. I refused to go to Iraq, to Baghdad, because I was actually in Israel, so I was very close. And I was asked to go and I said, I'm not going. And I said, no, I ain't going. I've been to too many war zones and I have a wife and two children and it's not worth it for a job. So I was called a mouse and I was told I could get a job on the Kerry Ann Kennelly show. But I would have done that. I maybe not worked on the Kerry Ann Kennelly show. I might have left television altogether. But I was not going to go to Baghdad. But luckily for me, there were a stack of younger cameramen or two or three younger cameramen that were keen to go and loved war zones and they can have it. It's just not worth it.
Mm.
So many journalists have been killed.
It's a cutthroat business though. And when you came home, you must have told your wife, gee whiz, we were in the wrong place but we got away with it in Northern Ireland. Did she ever say, no, that's it, you stop now, I can't have this?
Often she said that. Yep, she did. I've got the greatest wife on the planet. She said it often, you know. She said, enough's enough, you know, but I kept going, very foolishly of me.
And she... stuck with you.
Well, she did. She did. It went close sometimes, and I can't blame her. It's tough. We had two kids. I'm away 9 months of the year. She's like a single mother bringing up two kids alone.
Yeah.
It's unfair. It's a selfish job. It should be a single man's job.
Mm. Single woman's job too, I suppose.
Yeah,
I remember being in a car with a producer once who was, you know, wife was at home and putting the bins out and the kids were fighting and one of them was sick and he was describing the splendour of the hotel that we were in and we were all making the throat, stop, stop. And he said, oh, the phone line's gone dead. I can't imagine what's happened. Sat him down, took him through it. But then, of course, you fall in love on the road.
I fell in love on the road. Even though I was happily married, I fell in love on the road and she was 80.
Catherine Hepburn.
I'd been a fan all my life and we get to interview Catherine Hepburn. And not only that, she invited Mike Munro and I in the day before the interview to come and check out the house. So Mike and I go in. As we're walking in, she says, who's the cameraman? She talked like this. Who's the cameraman? I said, I'm. She said, well, Nick, where are you going to put me? And I thought, I've got to think quickly. So I said, well, do you have a favourite chair? She said, I do. And I said, well, that's where I'm going to put you. She said, Nick, that was the right answer. And she was just wonderful. She's 80. She's beautiful. I spent hours lighting her, but I could have lit her with a torch. She's so beautiful. And she loved Australia, loved Mike Munro, loved the interview. She was amazing.
You found yourself in the room. I mean, usually you would light your longtime sound operator, Mickey Breen, who, you know, while a charming fellow, looks nothing like Catherine Hepburn. She wouldn't have a bar of that.
No, she came down. No, actually, we had a female producer, so I put Jenny in and I'm like, and Catherine comes down and says, who's that? And I thought, oh, buggered the whole thing now. I've put someone in her favourite chair.
Who's that sitting in my chair?
Exactly. So I thought, oh, I'm in trouble. So I said, well, this is Jenny, our producer. And I said, I'm just setting up lights. And she said, why don't you light me? I said, I'd love to light you, but you don't want to sit here for half an hour. She said, I'm sure you'd do a much better lighting job if you lit me. The great Catherine Hepburn sat down and let me fiddle with lights for half an hour while she kept up small talk that Richard Carlton was incapable of for half an hour. She just sat there.
Here's how the interview went. This is the best part, I think, when she talks about Spencer Tracy, the love of her life. Their relationship, of course, was known but never public, and she never talked about it.
Their last movie together was Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Tracy died just 2 weeks after its completion, and it was Kate Hepburn who discovered his body.
His final speech in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, I think, was one of the most moving things.
I've never seen it.
You've never seen it?
No.
Really?
Never seen the picture.
Why?
Oh.
It hurt too much.
Couldn't look at the picture.
What did her face look like when she was saying that?
She started to cry. And then the amazing astute Catherine Hepburn took over and she sucked that tear straight back into that eye and she was back to being tough. But I zoomed in for a closer shot because I could see her welling up and it was gone. That's how tough she is.
Yeah. What made you stop shooting?
I had a brain hemorrhage, which is a bit of a shame. It was really bad luck, but I get to spend more time with Susie and the kids and stuff. But I was very lucky. I mean, you think, how lucky can you be having a brain hemorrhage? But I was in Melbourne shooting a story. I had a day off and then I was off to LA the next day. So I came to Sydney, and that one day in Sydney I had a brain hemorrhage. So I could have had it in a war zone. I could have had it on the plane. I could have had it anywhere, but I had it at home. So if you're going to have a brain hemorrhage, you might as well have it at home.
And now?
Well, now I'm fine. I was paralysed a bit down my left side. That lasted a year or so. It's gone. I'm happy. I'm spending time with Susie. I've moved to the bush. And so it's just, life's terrific.
And you've outed yourself. As Liz Hayes says on the front of this book, who knew the best storyteller was going to be the cameraman? You shouldn't have been having those nice drinks. You should have been back in the boring hotel room scripting the story because you're such a great writer. So we've got you.
Thanks, Ellen. Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun to write because what I did was relive all those great memories. That's why it was so much fun.
Wonderful. The book is called, is that your phone?
I hope not. That's somewhere it could be very unprofessional.
Very unprofessional. Oh, what was the penalty for your phone going off at 60 minutes? Was it a slab of beer? Usually,
I think it probably was a slab of beer.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't drink beer, but you owe me. Okay. The book is called All This in 60 Minutes by my guest Nicholas Lee. You're listening to Life Matters with me, Ellen Fanning.